Good afternoon. My name is Owen Egan, and I am the chairman of the Freedom of Information Commission. This is the regular meeting of the commission, April 12th, 2023. The public may listen to the meeting in real time by following the instructions listed at the top of the commission meeting agenda currently posted on the commission's website. In addition, this meeting is being recorded in its entirety. For the benefit of the public, particularly those who may be listening to the meeting by telephone, I'll take a roll call so that the record reflects who is participating today. When I say your name, please indicate that you are present. Commissioner Barry. Commissioner Einhorn.
Here.
Commissioner Fuseschi.
Here.
Commissioner Hankins.
Here.
Mr. Streeter.
Here.
And myself, Chairman Owen Egan. Here. Similarly, when the commission conducts a vote, it will be by roll. The first item is consideration of the minutes of the commission meeting of March 22nd, 2023. Do I hear a motion?
Mr. Chairman, Commissioner Streeter, I move adoption of the minutes of the commission's regular meeting of March 22nd, 2023.
Second.
Motion's been made and seconded. I'll take a roll. Commissioner Einhorn?
Yes.
Commissioner Fuseschi?
I was not there.
Okay. Commissioner Hankins?
Yes.
Commissioner Streeter?
Yes.
And myself, Owen Egan, yes. Thank you. Next, we will consider the hearing officer's reports. I will call the docket. Thank you. If you wish to address the commission on a particular docket number, please let me know when I call it, and we will mark it ready. We will take up the cases in the order that they are called. So the first is FIC 2021-02280. Again, 2021-0280, Hector Torres versus Jason Thode, Chief Police Department, City of Hartford, et al. Mr. Torres, are you there?
I do not wish to participate.
Okay. Is anyone there from the City of Hartford? I'd entertain a motion.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioner Streeter, this was a withdrawal and a dismissal, and as was mentioned, the complainant chose not to participate. I move adoption of the hearing officer's report.
Second.
Motion's been made and seconded. Is there any discussion? I'll take a roll of those in favor. Commissioner Einhorn?
Yes.
Commissioner Fuseschi?
Yes.
Commissioner Hankins?
Yes.
Commissioner Streeter?
Yes.
And myself, Owen Egan, yes. Passes unanimously. Next is docket number FIC 2021-0337, John DeLorio versus Governor, State of Connecticut, Office of the Governor, et al. Is Mr. DeLorio there, please? Is anyone there from the Governor's office?
Yes, this is an Attorney General Almond Medley for the Governor, and you don't wish argument because Mr. Chairman is not present.
Thank you, Counsel. I'd entertain a motion.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioner Streeter, this was a complainant failed to appear and dismissed. Seeing no objection from the responding Assistant Attorney General, I move to adoption of the hearing officer's report.
Commissioner Hankins, second.
Motion's been made and seconded. Any discussion? Hearing none, I'll take a roll call of those in favor. Commissioner Einhorn?
Yes.
Mr. Fuseschi?
Yes.
Commissioner Hankins?
Yes.
Commissioner Streeter?
Yes.
And myself, Owen Egan, passes unanimously. Thank you, Counsel. Next is FIC 2021-0631, Kristen Norton versus Town Manager, Town of South Windsor, et al. Is there anyone here on that matter? Kristen Norton, are you here? Is there anyone here from the Town of South Windsor? I'd entertain a motion.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioner Streeter, this was a dismissal. Seeing neither party present, I move adoption of the hearing officer's report.
Commissioner Hankins, second.
Motion's been made and seconded. Is there discussion? Hearing none, I'll take a roll call of those in favor. Commissioner Einhorn?
Yes.
Commissioner Fuseschi?
Yes.
Commissioner Hankins?
Yes.
Mr. Streeter?
Yes.
And myself, Owen Egan, yes. Passes unanimously. Next is docket number FIC 2022-0157, Martin and Lilia Hainer versus First Selectman, Town of Greenwich et al. Is there anyone here on that matter?
Here.
You are?
We're both here, yeah.
Who's here?
Your name?
Lillian Martin.
Lillian Martin and Martin Hanner?
Yes.
Okay. You're both here. Great.
You'd like to address the commission.
And for the respondents, Abby Wadler, Assistant Town Attorney for the Town of Greenwich.
I'm sorry, Counsel, what's your last name?
Wadler, W-A-D-L-E-R.
Thank you. Right, we'll mark that ready. Next is docket number FIC 2022-0167, Daniel Dunn versus Chief Police Department, Town of Hampden, et al.
Mr. Dunn's here, his attorney, Joseph Sastry. Can you address the commission, please?
Is there anyone here from the Town of Hampden?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Brian LeClaire Bertram Moses representing Hampden respondents.
Thank you. We'll mark that ready. Next is FIC 2022-0176, David Collins and the Day versus Chief Police Department, City of New London, et al. Is there anyone here from the Day? Is there anyone here from New London?
Yeah.
I'd entertain a motion.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Streeter, seeing need the party present, I move adoption of the hearing officer's report.
Second, Commissioner Einhorn.
Motion's been made and seconded. Is there discussion? Hearing none, I'll take a roll call of those in favor. Commissioner Einhorn?
Yes.
Commissioner Fusashi?
Yes.
Commissioner Hankins?
Yes.
Commissioner Streeter?
Yes.
And myself, Owen Egan, yes. Passes unanimously. Next is docket number FIC 2022-0182, Johanna Fay versus Chief Police Department, City of Bridgeport, et al. Is Johanna Fay there, please?
Yes, I would like to address the commission.
Okay, thank you. Is there anyone here from the City of Bridgeport?
Yes, Steve Scalo, Office of the City Attorney, and I'd like to be heard as well, please.
Thank you. Mark that ready. Next is docket number FIC 2022-0183, Johanna Fay versus Chief Police Department, City of Bridgeport, et al. Ms. Fay, would you like to be heard on that again?
Yes, these matters were consolidated for the hearing, so I can address both.
Attorney Scalo, you'd like to be
yes,
heard?
Yes, please. I'd like to also be heard. Yeah, I can address them at the same time as well.
Okay. So, do you need a motion to consolidate those?
So they were treated as consolidated for the hearing, and the parties agreed to argument consolidation, I think, we're fine.
Okay, so we don't have a separate motion. Thanks. Okay. Next is FIC 2022-0347, Elliot Kamen versus First Selectwoman, Office of the Selectman Town of Darien, et al. Is there anyone here on that matter?
Aaron Mayer from William and Dana on behalf of the complainant.
Is there anyone else here from the Town of Darien?
Wayne Fox on Darien, sir.
Wayne Fox?
Yes, sir.
Thank you. We'll mark that ready. Next is docket number FIC 2022-0540, Nancy Lallier versus Chairperson, Connecticut Technical Education and Career System Board, et al. Is Nancy Lallier there, please?
Yes.
Would you like to be heard?
Yes, please.
Thank you. Is there anyone here from the Connecticut Technical...
Respondent,
Sue Scott. Attorney Sue Scott. We'll mark that ready. All right, great. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, we have the recording on for people to call in and listen to the meeting, and I've just been informed that people are having trouble hearing, so I just want to double check that before we proceed.
So you want us to pause?
Yes.
Okay. So I'll just recap. We're going forward with these cases. Docket number FIC 2022-0157, Martin and Lillian Hainer versus First Selectman, Town of Greenwich et al. Next is docket number FIC 2022-0167, Daniel Dunn versus Chief Police Department, Town of Hampden et al. Next is docket number FIC 2022-0182, Johanna Fay versus Chief Police Department, City of Bridgeport et al., consolidated with docket number FIC 2022-0183, Johanna Fay versus Chief Police Department, City of Bridgeport et al., and docket number FIC 2022-0347, Elliot Kamen versus First Select Woman, Office of the Selectman, Town of Darien et al., and finally, docket number FIC 2022-0540, Nancy Lollier versus Chairperson, Connecticut Technical Education and Career System Board et al. So those are the matters that have been marked ready. Everything else has been ruled upon. Finally, before we consider these cases, I will ask the Executive Director, Colleen Murphy, to please make the usual announcements.
Sure. As the chairman indicated, the proceedings are being recorded in their entirety. And if anybody would like access to any of the matters that are on today's agenda, those will be posted to our website very soon after the meeting. Should have any issues with that, let us know. And pursuant to our regulations, oral arguments, 10 minutes per side. I'll keep track of that for the parties.
Thank you. So we'll call the first matter that's been marked ready, docket number FIC 2022-0157, Martin and Lillian Kanier versus First Selectman, Town of Greenwich et al. Would you come forward, please? The complainants can sit over here. The Kaniers can sit over here, and the respondents can sit over here. Please. I just asked the parties to identify themselves for the record.
My name is Martin Henner.
Lillian Henner.
Andy Walker.
And you're an attorney.
To the Town of Greenwich.
Thank you. So would the town like to begin?
Well, the town is requesting that the proposed decision by the hearing officer be adopted. I can go through the decision, but the town does recognize that the first four lines would not be exempt, but that the body of the memo would be exempt as a privileged communication between attorneys on town matters.
Thank you.
So they're prepared to do so.
Thank you. Mr. Henner.
Yes. I just wanted to thank the commission for hearing the case. I wanted to thank Hearing Officer Hyde for his report. We are in general in acceptance with the report. We just wanted to quickly voice our, this has been a long fight to basically resolve certain things. The idea always was to resolve any of this amicably. Hence our hearing with the then second selectman, Sandy Litwick. And frankly, we just feel somewhat frustrated that the time was taken in terms of getting all our information, whereas the town pretty much knew this was going to end up in 1-210-10 or exemption 5, client lawyer privilege. And it's adopted law. There's nothing we can do about it. But in general, when a municipality just uses taxpayer money to basically hear you out and at the end basically lock down, that is just absolute and total frustration to us. We are ending up with a landlocked property. We ended up with a property that has a water runoff. And the town simply is not willing to listen, is not willing to respond. And so that's pretty much all that we just wanted the commission to hear, that frankly, client lawyer privilege is a nice thing, but does it have any place in municipalities? Frankly, the municipality is us, it's we the people. And if a municipality is allowed to act against their residents, then frankly, this is just unjust. And that's all we have to say. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you. Do you wish to respond?
Well, I mean, I'll just say that the town did respond very quickly to the request and asserted a recognized exemption to the act for a good reason, not as a manipulation. I'm sorry it was misinterpreted.
Thank you.
May I respond to that?
Sure.
Frankly, throughout the hearing of August 17 of 2022, respondent lawyer constantly reminded us in the meeting, no clue what this is all about, not even knowing what the memo was about. So we felt the frustration for us, because bottom line is we have documented on and on to the second selectman exactly what this is about. We clearly stated the regulations. And I guess with the town having to come to Hartford and showing the memo on the camera, that clearly showed partially the frustration of hearing Officer Hyde as well. And so the town's responsiveness during the matter since we found out about the zoning violations of 2018 was absolutely zero. Thank you.
Do any of the commissioners wish to comment?
Just a simple comment. This is painfully going back to property law in law school, but I mean, you know, we're just here, you know, for a small section of what appears to be your problems. But, you know, I just go out on a limb and say,
I fully agree.
No, but Mr. Hanna, we're not the commission's not the only game in town if you have a landlocked parcel, okay? So, and I don't know anything about it. I don't want to know anything about it because that'll bring me back sitting in law school a class for 3 hours, yeah. Times, whatever. But we're not the only game in town, okay? We'll just leave it at that.
Great. Can I entertain a motion, please?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Streeter, I move adoption of the hearing officer's report.
Commissioner Hackett, second.
Motion's been made and seconded. Is there discussion? Hearing none. We'll take a roll call of those in favor. Commissioner Einhorn?
Yes.
Commissioner Pizzashi?
Yes.
Commissioner Hankins?
Yes.
Commissioner Streeter?
Yes.
And myself, Owen Egan, yes. Passes unanimously. Thank you very much, Mr. Senator. Thank you very much. Calling docket number FIC 2022-0167, Daniel Dunn versus Chief Police Department, Town of Hamden, et al. Will the parties identify themselves, please, starting with you, sir?
Sure, Daniel Dunn, Hamden resident.
Joseph Sastry, Mr. Dunn's attorney.
Could you speak up? I'm sorry.
Joseph Sastry.
Thank you.
And for the record, Brian LeClaire representing all of the respondents.
Thank you. So would you like to begin, Attorney LeClaire?
Sure, I'll be very brief. This matter was one in which we reached a resolution between days one and day two of the hearing. The town did indicate that there was a technical violation that occurred, indicated several specific steps that were taken to prevent this from happening again. And as indicated in our brief memorandum, we have no objection to the adoption of the report of the hearing officer.
Thank you. Counsel.
Thank you. We just have one reservation as to the hearing officer's report, and that's that paragraph 10 contains a factual error. Where it states that, actually it's a factual error within a factual error, I believe, that we agreed that the town of Hamden destroyed the documents within the promulgated time frame. We didn't actually agree to that, and it isn't true. Most of the time frame that the town asked the public records administrator for permission to destroy was within the permissible timeframe. The tail end of it, one on January 1st, 2020 through March 2nd, 2020, that time frame was not yet ripe for destruction. So while it won't, I don't think would make any difference as to the hearing officer's ultimate decision, I do think that it's worth noting that that tail end of the request for permission to destroy was outside the ripeness guidelines, just in the interest of not having such an incident repeat itself.
Thank you. Attorney Murphy. Something that we should amend or can amend?
I think the records should indicate, if I may, Mr. Chairman, that the records were destroyed as indicated with the authorization of both the public records administrator and the state archivist of the state of Connecticut. It wasn't a random destruction of records. It was with the explicit approval of those two state officials.
Do you concur with what
I don't quite don't follow the argument. When I read the brief, I was a little confused about that, to be honest with you. And I don't know that it's relevant to the ultimate resolution of this either.
You said that some of the records they stipulated were destroyed in an appropriate manner and others were not destroyed in a timely manner.
We believe they were all destroyed appropriately and with the approval of the state of Connecticut.
The paragraph doesn't indicate that the complainants...
Yeah, that, I didn't see that either.
It's saying that the this is what the respondents...
No, that's true.
...said. Mm-hmm.
Nothing to do with the complainants, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Is there another paragraph other than 10 that you're referring to? It does say the respondent stipulated.
Well, for the respondents to stipulate it, I understand that to mean that we therefore also assented in that stipulation. If that's not the commission's understanding, I could appreciate that. But the fact of the matter is that it still lays out a decision that suggests that they were, in fact, all within the time frame, and that has been one of our complaints through throughout the proceedings. We showed the promulgated regulations. We pointed out the time frame. I do think that it's worth considering an amendment, either to remove the portion that says that it was done within the permissible time frame, and to go so closer to...
What paragraph are you referring to?
In paragraph 10, to say that it was done with the blessing of the state records administrator would be fine for, in my view. But to say, to suggest that it was done properly within the ripeness guidelines, I think is a somewhat dangerous misstatement of fact.
So
we have no jurisdiction over that.
I don't think so. Anything that it says that
it's not a matter of jurisdiction, it's a matter of fact. The matter of fact is that the state.
So how would you tell us how you'd amend paragraph 10? I'm not saying we're going to do it. I just want to know, how would you like paragraph 10 to be amended?
I would just say that it was stipulated that it was done with the authority of the state records administrator rather than that it was done in accordance with the guidelines. Because if the guidelines weren't adhered to by the state records administrator, although I understand that the commission believes that it doesn't have that sort of jurisdiction, it's still worth noting that it was done incorrectly so that this municipality or another doesn't then turn around and then repeat the same mistake.
I would just take respondents' counsel at his word, you know, that they were done with the permission of two state entities.
Yes, that's correct. It's the Leanne Burbank, the Public Records Administrator, and Lizette Pelletier, the State Archivist, both need to sign off on the form, as you may know, before records are destroyed.
And we don't have any issue with the record reflecting that, but for it to reflect that it was done within the ripeness guidelines.
So you don't like the language that says that in accordance with the state's records retention schedule.
Right. If it just didn't, instead of saying retention schedule, said something like to the effect of
procedure.
Retention procedure, procedure as far as, you know, the state.
Procedure.
Do you have any objection to that?
No, Mr. Chairman.
And you want to put in accordance with what those two people are, you said?
We could add that as well.
I would like that. That makes it more specific that it, you know, the failure is on them. It's not on.
Would that be okay with the response council?
Yes.
Oh, come on. I'm skating on thin ice as it is.
Does the hearing officer like to?
Yeah, if the hearing, Attorney Hyde, can you
Attorney Hyde.
Think of an appropriate amendment?
Public records administrator and
state archivist?
Sure. For the record, Attorney Zach Hyde, I would propose an amendment to paragraph 10. On the fourth line, to remove with the state's records retention schedule in accordance with the state's records retention schedule, and instead say with approval from the proper state officials, or do you want to put the exact names or titles in?
Maybe you could say, you know, we're destroyed in accordance with the state records retention procedure and approval of the state public records administrator and state archivist.
If I may,
that's nice. I like that one.
If it could reflect that it was done with their permission rather than the procedure, since the procedure also wasn't.
Well, I think approval does that.
Approval does. It says that as a matter of fact, it was approved. It doesn't mean that they stuck to the correct procedure. I don't mean to be a dancer.
The procedure is to go to the state archivist and state public records.
You know, belt suspenders on that one, I think.
And we agree with that.
So do you want to propose the amendment, Mr. Hankins?
Yes, Attorney Hyde, I believe you had formulated something.
You can try it if you want.
I'll think. Mr. Chairman, Commissioner Streeter, I make a motion that we amend paragraph 10 to the final word where it says schedule, change that to procedure and continue on, and approval of the state's public records administrator and state archivist.
I'll second it.
Is there discussion on the amendment? Hearing none, I'll take a roll call on both of those in favor of the amendment. Mr. Einhorn.
Yes.
Mr. Dugessi.
Yes.
Mr. Hankins.
Yes.
Mr. Streeter.
Yes.
And myself, all in unison. Yes. The amendment passes unanimously. Anything further on the matter as amended?
No, Mr. Chairman.
No, thank you.
Entertain a motion.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Streeter, I move adoption of the amended hearing officer's report.
Mr. Hankins, second.
Is there a discussion?
Just one thing. Attorney Hyde, the compliance counsel stated in his brief that you had presented falsehoods in this case. Are you aware of any falsehoods that you presented?
No.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Any further discussion? All right, I'll take a roll call in favor of this as amended. Mr. Einhorn?
Yes.
Mr. Kuzeshi?
Yes.
Mr. Hankins?
Yes.
Mr. Streeter?
Yes.
And myself, Owen Egan, yes, passes unanimously.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
All right, thank you,
sir. Next, we have two matters, docket number FIC 2022-0182. And docket number FIC 2022-0183 with the following parties, Johanna Fay versus Chief Police Department, City of Bridgeport et al. And again, Johanna Fay versus Chief Police Department, City of Bridgeport et al. Will the parties please come forward? So the parties agree that these two matters can be consolidated. First of all, identify yourself to the record.
Johanna Fay, the plaintiff.
Thank you.
Dean Scalo, Office of the City Attorney, for all the respondents.
Thank you. Do the parties agree that these matters can be consolidated?
Yes. Yes.
And the record will reflect that both said yes. Thank you. So when it's later, we have Attorney Scalo begin.
Sure.
Please.
So for these consolidated matters, as we've discussed, they were heard as essentially one hearing. It involves two requests, but they really are for the same sort of batch of records, same time period of records. The records requested in the first request are really subsumed by the records that were sought in the second request. So it made sense to hear them together, and it made sense for the overall case to be heard as one. With respect to the proposed final decisions, the city has a few issues with the findings of fact and conclusions of law. There are a number of mixed findings of fact and conclusions of law in this case. We submitted the post-hearing brief for consideration by the commission, so I won't go too in-depth for the arguments that are laid out therein, but I'd like to touch on those a little bit and then touch on the additional arguments in light of the proposed final decision. So the city's first issue really surrounds the content of the complaint itself. The first issue is that really the only valid allegation that is contained in the complaint is that Attorney Fay pled that she, quote, did not receive a response to her request within four business days. The city's position, and this is well supported by commission precedent, is that the city is not required to provide responsive records within four business days. Even interpreting this appeal as pleading that the complainant did not receive records within four business days, it's not a valid complaint. It's not a valid allegation under the FOI Act. Generously interpreting this to mean that the complainant did not receive an acknowledgement of receipt at the very least within four business days, the record and the evidence in the record doesn't bear that out. Attorney Fay agreed on the record, admitted in her testimony that she did receive our acknowledgements of receipt. So really the whole complaint is based upon this allegation that is not a sufficiently valid allegation that the city violated the FOI Act. In these two proposed final decisions, there's a suggestion that the respondents are really reading this one claim in a vacuum, but we disagree with that. Really, it's the only true, well-pled, specific allegation in the complaint. There are a number of other factual allegations, claims that are laid out, but the only real allegation, especially taking into account when the complaint was filed, was that the city did not respond to the complainant's request within four business days. And the commission has found again and again that that's not a valid basis upon which a complaint can be submitted before the commission. Beyond that, again, the hearing officer elected, or the two hearing officers elected, to continue not only just hearing sort of general findings of fact, or making findings of fact rather, as to promptness and the redactions, claims of exemptions. That sort of leads into our second point, that because the complaint was submitted in the time period before she had received responsive records, the complaint cannot validly claim that the city violated the FOI Act with respect to the exemptions claimed. This is another case where, in between filing of the complaint and the first hearing, Attorney Fay was provided records responsive to her request, and it was really at the first hearing that she alleged that the city had violated the FOI Act with respect to various claims of exemption. My understanding is that even up to this day, there has never been an amended complaint that has been filed in this matter. It's an example of sort of the goalposts of the scope of the complaint being moved throughout the lifetime of the complaint. The commission is a quasi-judicial public entity, and in its own regulation specifies that the scope of the hearing is to be an inquiry into the allegations in the complaint. So it's the city's position, and this is backed up by the court's position when it comes to pleadings in civil matters, that the complainant can't really come in on the day of the hearing and allege new allegations that were not fairly pled in the complaint. In fact, the Freedom of Information Commission itself, last summer, I believe, rejected this kind of policy of coming in after the complaint has been filed at the hearing and alleging that redactions are now at issue when they weren't fairly pled in the complaint, when the respondents had really received very little, if any, specific notice as to what would be at issue. It makes it difficult for the respondents to come to the hearing prepared to provide evidence because they don't know what redactions are at issue. And I have the case that the commission, in fact, elected not to take the hearing officer's report as written, rejected that finding. It was David Marcato, speed town planner, senior enforcement officer, town of New Canaan. And this was at the June 22nd, 2022 regular meeting, in which this body, in a very similar case, in which it was a similar disclosure of records between the time that the complaint was filed and the complaint was really based on just promptness, and the hearing officer made findings of fact as to redactions, this body found that it was inappropriate given just regular pleading practice and fundamental fairness and due process considerations for the commission to make findings of fact as to redactions in that case. So I've strained to try to find the difference between the case at hand here and that decision that the commission made last summer. I can't see any. I think it makes a lot of sense to limit the factual findings that the hearing officer makes to those issues that are fairly pled in the complaint. And the suggestion was that, you know, lay people may not know to plead allegations specifically in a complaint. I don't think that's true. I think a lot of people, a lot of lay people and attorneys understand that if you come to the commission seeking redress, you can't, you know, 6 months down the line or whenever the hearing occurs, sort of change the scope of what the commission is being asked to rule on. So that's really the largest issue here. And then it leads into the problems with the findings of fact when it comes to the redactions. Again, the respondents cooperated. We provided records for in-camera inspection. I testified because I was the individual who redacted the records. This is a case file of a homicide in the 80s, I believe, 1988. And so as the proposed final decision discusses, there's really little institutional knowledge when it comes to case files that are this old. And I think unreasonably, the proposed final decision sort of hang their factual findings on that, saying, well, you know, there's nobody who can testify with specificity as to the contents of the records because of how old they are. Therefore, the testimony proving that the redactions were proper and in accordance with the law can't really be afforded much weight. And the city completely disagrees with that approach. It's inconsistent with just the plain language of the Freedom of Information Act. It's inconsistent with just practical application of the law. Generally speaking, if an individual takes sort of a conscientious approach and really reads the contents of the documents that are at issue, along with incorporating feedback of individuals currently working who know what these types of records are and know the strategies and purposes of keeping these records, then that should really meet the evidentiary threshold when it comes to the analysis as to whether the exemptions apply. And then this will sort of lead me into issues concerning the factual findings. We first and foremost disagree with the findings that the respondents did not adequately prove that 1210B3A, which applies to unknown witnesses who could be subject to threat or intimidation or harm, didn't prove their evidentiary burden with that. And it's worth reminding, you know, this body, although, you know, this body certainly knows that the evidentiary threshold in administrative proceedings is the preponderance of the evidence. So it's really more likely than not. That's the way that the courts have sort of colloquially assessed that evidentiary burden. Without getting too much into the facts of the case, there was an initial disclosure of responsive records that was made, really just kind of taking into account publicly available materials, materials the complainant provided in terms of other requests. And then after that, the respondents coordinated with the complainant and received a list of witnesses and conducted additional research on Westlaw and other publicly available materials and determined that certain individuals were known because they had testified at trial or at the very least were known to the complainant and withdrew their claims of exemption for those individuals. However, there are individuals that remain where the complainant has not proved that she knows who they are. To our satisfaction, there's no publicly available material within our research that we've been able to deduce. So really, it's beyond a preponderance of the evidence that certain witnesses are not otherwise known to the public. And with respect to proving that those witnesses would be harmed or threatened or intimidated, to the extent that they are still living and still in the area, the fact that the case is older doesn't necessarily remove the threat that is inherent in cases that involve violent crimes such as homicides. There was significant testimony put forth in the hearing regarding this issue. It doesn't take away the fact that the city of Bridgeport has experienced issues of witness intimidation. It's been well reported. It was pled in our brief. It was discussed at the hearing. It doesn't attenuate that risk in any way, in our opinion. And certainly given the testimony in the record, the hearing officer had ample evidence before her to make a finding that the redactions, just as to the witness statements, were valid and proper, certainly beyond a preponderance of the evidence. There are some other findings of fact that we have some concerns with, specifically the findings of fact with respect to the preliminary drafts and notes. Again, this is another one of those findings that hinges upon the fact that the case file was old and that the individuals who may have made the notes or the drafts couldn't necessarily speak themselves to the purpose of them. I don't believe that that's really the inquiry that should be made. As the proposed final decision notes, the respondents provided testimony that the balancing act that's required under statute was done and that a determination was made that the drafts, and many of these are handwritten notes, as the proposed final decision mentions, that the interest in confidentiality outweighed the interest in public disclosure just because of the nature of the notes, the contents, the fact that they're handwritten notes and that they are clearly sort of preliminary markings in a case file. I think just with that alone, there's testimony that proves that that exemption was claimed. So the fact that the materials were old, I don't think it's an argument that holds water, because just viewing the documents in and of themselves, taking a careful approach, you can deduce sort of the purpose and the nature of the documents in that fashion. Again, with respect to the findings of fact as to 1210B3H, which is uncorroborated materials, the city's position is that on its face, that record is clearly an uncorroborated allegation that's been reduced to a report, coupled with other information in the in-camera inspection. The findings of fact could clearly have gone the other way. With respect to that particular report, it is a matter that was a sexual assault complaint. So the respondents claimed that entire report as an uncorroborated allegation on its face. But in the event that the commission will still order that to be disclosed, we would ask that the hearing officer's reports at least be amended to allow for the redaction of the victim in that case, as is consistent with the FOI Act and with other law. Again, we believe that the report is exempt in full, but at least that material should be exempt from disclosure. Again, on its face, there isn't any additional kind of factual inquiry that needs to be made on that. And then just to touch on one final point, there's also findings of fact where the hearing officer discusses records that are medical records that are within the in-camera records. And finds, in fact, that they are medical records as contemplated by 1210B2, but finds that because nobody had objected to the disclosure of those records, that we hadn't met our burden to prove that they would be exempt under the statute. With all due respect, the commission has, I'm not aware of any provision in the FOI Act, and I certainly could be wrong, that requires a private individual to similarly object. There's provisions in the Act for employees whose personnel and medical or similar files, those are subject to objection by the employee. But for a private citizen, that similar mechanism is not present in the Act. And the commission has in the past, if I could direct your attention or ask that you take administrative notice of FIC 89-76, which is an instance where the commission evaluated Social Security numbers that were in responsive records that belonged to private individuals. And I'd like to quote really briefly here. It's found that the portions of the data referred to in paragraph 10, if disclosed over the objection of the subject, would lead to an invasion of personal privacy under the circumstances of this case. And then skipping down a bit, although it's found that the Social Security numbers requested pursuant to paragraph 2 above are not contained in personnel, medical, or similar files as anticipated by 19B2, which is now 1210B2, under the discrete circumstances presented, the commission, as a matter of discretion, declines to order disclosure of such Social Security numbers because it would lead to an invasion of the personal privacy of those individuals to whom the numbers belong and who lack the ability to object to disclosure in this case. The city would ask that in a clear instance where medical records are among the materials that were submitted for in camera, to the extent that they pertain to private individuals who are not afforded the same opportunities to object as public employees, that the commission in their discretion declined to order disclosure, even though they may not meet the exact, I guess, purpose of the act, which contemplates employee medical or personnel files. They still are medical files as specifically noted in 1210b2, and we would argue that they're likewise exempt from disclosure on that basis alone. But if the commission doesn't agree with our reading of the statute, the commission certainly has the discretion to decline to order disclosure of those medical records. And I think that just about does it. I can go on, but I'd be glad to answer any questions. But in short, we think that the proposed final decisions in this consolidated matter, they're largely the same. I think they're almost entirely the same, contain a number of errors of fact and law such that the proposed final decisions should be reversed in their entirety. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Attorney Scalin. Attorney Fay.
Good afternoon. So I think that my post-hearing brief responds to the majority of the arguments that Attorney Scalo put forth. There are a couple of things that I do want to address specifically. First, this claim that the only valid allegation in the complaint is promptness, I think just grossly mischaracterizes the complaint. The complaint on the face of it in multiple sections says that the central allegation is that records were being improperly withheld and weren't subject to exemptions. There's, I think the second or third to last paragraph of the complaint is an entire paragraph that addresses that allegation. So, you know, I think that's just simply not true. This issue of the acknowledgement of a receipt, I think that the hearing officer's report does address it in paragraph 15, but I do think that's something that's likely, if it hasn't come up before the commission before, is likely to come up again, and I think it's important that that's something the commission clearly addresses. The respondents are arguing that because they sent this automatic acknowledgement of receipt immediately after receiving the request, it's sufficient to exempt the respondents from the four-day statutory denial provision. And that's honestly something I find troubling, because if this commission were to determine that was the case, it would exempt public agencies from the constructive denial provision entirely just by acknowledging receipt, not formally denying a request, and the commission would just never have jurisdiction over any appeal. So I think, you know, I mean, that's the reason the constructive denial provision is there, is so that public agencies aren't able to skirt the commission's jurisdiction in that way. Also, just with regards to the Marquitos case, I addressed this pretty thoroughly in my brief. I don't think it's necessary for me to give that full argument here, but it's certainly distinguishable from this. And it's the complaint at issue was truly just an allegation of the promptness requirement. There was nothing about records being withheld. In addition to that, the complainant in that matter waived that four-day constructive denial provision and gave additional time in the complaint itself for the respondents to respond in that case. You know, I mean, I think, again, the complaint itself just very clearly alleges the improper withholding of records. Whether they're being withheld in full or redacted, it really doesn't matter. It's the same situation. You know, I mean, you could redact an entire page of records that's still being withheld from the complainant. With regards to the exemptions, I think, again, I think these were pretty fairly evaluated by the hearing officer. You know, I mean, respondents could have had somebody from the Bridgeport PD testify to, you know, the purpose behind the notes that are in the file. To, you know, the threats to witnesses, to all of those matters, the respondents chose not to. They chose to rely merely on the arguments of their counsel. Counsel didn't provide any evidence at all, except for arguments based on one other case, which I address in my brief, that isn't similar at all to the case at hand. That was prior to conviction, there were two witnesses that were murdered by a defendant in a case. This case has already gone through the justice system. It's gone through multiple appeals. You know, everyone who's testified has already testified in this case. There's no threat to any witnesses here. And then You know, I think just in general, respondents are required to provide affirmative evidence. They can't rely on the lack of evidence on a matter to prove their point here. And no affirmative evidence was presented at all. With regard to the sexual assault exemption, that was never claimed when respondents provided these records at any point. This appeal has been ongoing since, I first received the records in, I believe, October of 2022. So they've had since then to make that claim with regard to those records. They haven't. Evidence hasn't been put forward in any evidentiary hearing. I haven't had the opportunity to dispute those claims. With regard to the medical records issue, again, during the evidentiary hearing, when respondents had the opportunity to put forth evidence on that issue, they put forth no evidence regarding the medical records issue at all. So this case regarding Social Security numbers, I think, is very distinguishable. It's, first of all, I specifically said I wasn't challenging Social Security numbers. I don't need those, don't want them. I said that during the evidentiary hearings. I think this is just not the same situation. I'm happy to answer any questions, but I think I would just ask that the commission adopt the hearing officer's report as written.
Mm-hmm. Ms. Gale, do you wish to respond?
Very briefly, please. So with respect to characterizing the evidence at the hearing as mere arguments of counsel, that's clearly incorrect given the scope of the hearing. Again, I am counsel of record, but I elected to go under oath and provide actual testimony. So these aren't just mere statements of counsel. They are evidence in the record based on my review of the records. With respect to the issue of a constructive denial, I talk about this a little bit in my brief, but the commission has found that the constructive denial, and the courts have actually affirmed this finding, the purpose of the constructive denial provision is for requesters who submit a request and never receive a response. And the idea is that when those 4 days elapse and a requester doesn't even receive any word from an agency, that they have redress, that they have the ability to go to the commission rather than wait for a response that may never arrive, and then their appeal period, that 30 days, runs out. That's not the case here. In this instance, the fact that the acknowledgement was sent automatically, it was sent immediately upon receipt and contained substantive information. It wasn't just sort of a boilerplate, we've received your request, thanks very much. It contained a reference number for both requests. It contained information about the way that we process requests. It contained some information about fees. The fact that the city utilizes software to assist and let requesters know, yes, your request has been received, we're not ignoring it, we got it, and we're working on it, that really speaks to the exact opposite principle that the constructive denial provision was meant to address. So I disagree with Attorney Faye's sort of characterization of the fact that she received a response immediately after submitting her request as somehow not meeting the requirements of the act. With respect to the claims that no evidence was presented as to certain issues at the hearing, the commission has found and the court has affirmed that in the cases of some records, it's able to be determined just on the face of the record, the character of the record, and what kind of record it is. So with respect to medical records, again, the hearing officer even found that the character of some of those records was medical records. You can look at a record and determine whether it's an ambulance report or a hospital report without any extrinsic evidence. It's absolutely fair to make that kind of finding. With respect to the sexual assault issue, it's the same kind of matter. It's, if you read the contents of the document, it's plain on its face that that's what kind of document that is. And again, the fact that specific evidence as to the contents of that record, the fact that it wasn't put forward at the hearing, it's nullified by the fact that the respondents claimed an entirely different exemption for that document in full. So really, it's just sort of covering the fact that should the commission order that document to be disclosed, that the material that has been largely, that there are various statutory mechanisms to protect the victims of sexual assault. Again, it's plain on its face. It doesn't require any additional factual finding. That can easily be done by the commission in its discretion. And I think that a lot of counsel's arguments here don't hold water, given the reading of the complaint itself. The court has, in a matter that's currently before the appellate court, has found that a complaint that is submitted before records are received cannot validly make any claims about the exemptions that are claimed as to those records because the exemptions haven't been claimed yet. And in this case, really widening the scope of the issues before the commission is kind of one of the biggest issues that the city has with these proposed final decisions. If the city is compliant and provides records in between the time that a complaint is filed, which in this case was filed shortly after the request was actually submitted, and a hearing, the complaint itself, unless an amended complaint is filed, which council certainly had the opportunity to do and did not, the respondents are really put at a disadvantage when it comes to knowing the claims that are at issue. And even as noted in the proposed final decision, even up until the post-hearing brief, the complainant was saying, well, we're not contesting these redactions. We're not contesting these redactions. It just makes it so difficult for the respondents to be able to know what claims are levied against them. And as noted by some of the cases in my brief that I cited, the courts say that a complaint has to specifically allege the violations that it is charging against the opposing party, and that these allegations cannot be merely sort of implied by conjecture or remote implication. And that's really exactly what happened in this case. This body has chosen not to go that route before in the interest of fundamental fairness, and we would argue that that absolutely should be done in this case as well. It just makes sense.
Thank you. Attorney Schwinn.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Now, after reviewing the entire file, the in-camera records, reviewing the testimony, looking at the complaint very carefully, it was clear to me that the complaint was sufficiently alleging that the complainant felt that they were deprived of the public records in their entirety. The complaint itself even mentions and alleges that any claim of exemption they would dispute. So I think the respondents were on clear, fair notice what this complaint was about. The complainant wanted the records. That was it. And just like any other case before the commission, if the respondents hope to withhold those records, it's their burden to prove the exemptions. So I listened carefully to the testimony. I didn't feel that the respondents proved application of the exemptions that were claimed, and so I wrote the report that way.
Thank you, Attorney Schwinn. Do the commissioners have any questions?
I do.
Commissioner Streeter.
Thank you, Commissioner Streeter. So this is one of those cases where I'm sympathetic to the city of Bridgeport, because I think the law, it's constraining and probably needs to be changed, because I think it stretches the credibility of the law that somebody can make two requests on the basis of the same day for items that are 46 to 35 years old that contain murders, and expect that there's not going to be some legal aspects or exemptions. And then when they get an automatic response, and that's another issue, but I think it's great that the city of Bridgeport automatically responses, because that's in the law. If you want to change that, then change it. Say you have to write a personal hand note or something. But they complied with the law immediately, and that's how it is in the law. So as far as the four-day notice, that already, they got notice. Yes, they didn't get the records. But for them to come and, an organization, what if it was four? What if it's five? What if it's 10 requests on the same day? We have constantly held that the promptness can take those things into consideration. And you have to say that you think you can snap your fingers and within four business days have somebody be able to come in and look at records that are from a generation ago. From the time I was in, I graduated in 87. So you're basically talking between the time I was in second grade to the time I graduated high school. You're looking for records. If I went to South Windsor High School or South Windsor Public Schools, there's no way they could find records going back that far. So I'm sympathetic that the city of Bridgeport, in this case, they have a significant amount. And if we're going to just allow people to constantly just say, I'm filing a promptness and I'm going to challenge any exemptions before they know what those exemptions are, I think this is definitely a case of moving the goalposts. I think that there probably needs to be, you know, something, action on the city of Bridgeport to, like, you know, constant communication to follow up on these within the time period. But it looks like this is a case where yes, there probably are. I trust the hearing officer implicitly that there probably are these exemptions. But how we got to this point is where I have the issue with. And I think this is something that the legislature, or maybe through court, if they appeal this case, and maybe that can be, either through the legislature or for the judicial branch, that 4 days is way too short a period for to say that you can, pin this down for. It's tough on a small town, let alone the largest city in Connecticut, to say that, there's a focal point that somehow they can allow people to inspect records within 4 days, or provide, 56 to 35-year-old or 50-year-old records in a flash. I'm not saying that I'll listen to my other colleagues, but I have sympathy for the city of Bridgeport. It may be tough for me to vote against them to support this, but this is a case where you have a case here. We've heard it from Attorney Scallo all the time, the burdens of the city and the numerous requests. We don't know whether other requests came in on this day. I mean, they could have had 10 other requests. They're probably getting them all the time. But this was, looks like a case where this organization, and these are old cases. I don't know if there's, I know we want to treat everybody fairly, but if these have been, Project Innocence, and you're saying what is going to happen, whether it's, a month or 2 months from now, depending on what the city does. Why did they wait, basically 35 years for this case, for these murders that happened in 1987. I mean, I'm not judging the balance there. I'm just saying that the time-wise and the way this was done, and that we're allowing more and more people to sort of just move the goalposts. I'm one of the few non-lawyers here, so I kind of always speak my mind, and I appreciate my colleagues to reel me in from time to time. So I'll allow them to say that. But this is one of those cases I think that the legislature needs to look at. I know our staff will not agree with me, but I'm just trying to think of common sense, how it applies to the citizens in the communities of the state. So I'll turn it back to you. Thank you.
I think I understand exactly what Commissioner Streeter is talking about. I mean, this is not the first or second time that Bridgeport has had ancient requests. Would that be correct? I mean, a couple of times, one or two meeting, you're here at Attorney Scale for this ancient, I would call them ancient, if they're older than Commissioner Streeter, I would say that they're not, old files. I am sympathetic too. I think we're constrained by the law, and one of the ways to get out of it would be to, to appeal it to the Superior Court. But, I think we're constrained to follow, politely, seasoned, a veteran hearing officer.
If I might just factually speaking, Mr. Streeter, just make note that the complaint wasn't filed like the day after the acknowledgement was received. There was a 30-day wait in between that request and the time that the complaint was filed. So I'm assuming there was no communication in between there.
I understood that. I'm saying, but it looked like that the complaints came on the same day.
Right. Complaints came on the same day. Yes.
So that's what I'm saying. And obviously they did not, I know they didn't respond. They didn't acknowledge it immediately,
mm-hmm.
instantaneously.
Right.
Yeah. But I'm saying that, yes, there was, that's why I'm saying I understand, but for them to say that the complaint was that, they didn't respond within 4 days, and I know that they didn't do it within 30 days.
But, you know,
but,
I think
but
that's the basis of, the decision about jurisdiction, though.
No, but I'm talking that it looked like that in the hearing officer's report, they're talking about that, you know, that they did, we're not, that they were, you know, it's just talking about our section here. Any person denied the right to inspect or copy records, you know, it's a short.
Right, and the denial, there were 30 days
yes,
in between the time that the request was made. So it wasn't like a trigger response, oh, I didn't get the records on the appeal. That's just the point that, mm-hmm. that I'm making in contrast to what you're saying. I appreciate what you're saying, but I just wanted to make sure that that was understood. It wasn't like the complainants filed the second they got an acknowledgement, but they were denied access to the records. They didn't have the records. So that's what our process is about, is to determine whether there was a violation, to give the complainants, you know, this process to determine whether there was.
We base the start time for the denial based on that expiration of those 4 days.
Not necessarily.
In this case, it sounds like it was.
I'll let the hearing officer speak to that.
Well, I made a finding that the automatic response was neither compliance or denial, and that the denial would come 4 days after that.
Yes.
So
and that started the
that's,
clock.
Yeah, that started the clock ticking, so to speak, and within the 30 days, the complainant then filed.
Yeah.
Because if the complainant had waited longer, they would have been unable to.
Yeah, I totally understand. Yeah. I'm saying I would like to see that time extended. I'd like to see that, yeah. You know, if you're going to automatically say that time, it should be more than 4 days. It should mm-hmm. be, even if it's 10 days, like the state of Massachusetts, and then you can have it 30 days beyond that, so it gives them 40 days to respond.
Yeah, that would require a statutory change.
That's what I'm saying.
Right. Yeah.
What I said is going to go to the legislature or the judicial. Mm-hmm.
What would have been the respondent's option during that 30-day period? Could they say we are going to begin compliance? Here are two records.
Yeah, that could have happened. We've seen that happen in other instances. Yeah, where there are communication between the parties, maybe trying to narrow the scope of whatever the request is. That type of thing happens all the time. Yeah.
If they did say we need additional time to gather the other records, would that have extended the complaints period of time to make file a complaint?
Possibly, yes. Yeah. But these are the facts that we had in this
right.
case. So.
No, I understand. Yeah. Thank you. Any other comments? Commissioner Fisashi?
I'm a little disadvantaged because I apologize. I'm not with you in person. I've listened to the arguments carefully. I have no position really on the statutory question or this statutory question. I do believe that our legislature is looking at a need to act on the timeliness issue and the commissions and the ability and municipalities to be fully incentivized and funded to act promptly. So on that issue, I feel strongly. On this issue, I really don't have an opinion. So, but I do have an opinion and a view on these two hearing officers' report. I fully support them based on the current law and based on this concept of certain pro bono organizations, really the Innocence Project among them, trying to do good work on looking back at some older cases and trying to find justice and facts, looking back at cases which have a history which make it worthy, perhaps, to look at them. So on principle, I am very much in support of these decisions, and on the articulation of the hearing officer's report, I am in support of the decisions of these two hearing officers' reports, and that is my view. And I'm sorry, I'm not there to personally say it, in the room.
Thank you. Anything further? Anyone? All right.
Mr. Chairman, excuse me, can I have an indulgence of 30 seconds?
Sure.
Attorney
Scarlett.
I With respect to the statutory requirement, the four-day issue is one thing. Again, what the city is arguing is that the scope of the complaint be limited to those facts fairly pled in the complaint. I understand the hearing officer's argument that a statement that the complainant believes that no exemptions apply in the commission's view may be enough to open the door for factual findings as to the exemptions. But really, the statute doesn't opine specifically as to the scope of the complaint and the hearing officer's response to it, but the regulations do. The regulations provide that the point of a hearing is to make an inquiry into the allegations fully and fairly pled in the complaint. And the court has held that a complaint should fairly put the defendant on notice of the claims against him. Essential allegations may not be supplied by conjecture or remote implication. So simply making a blanket statement that no exemptions apply before knowing what the documents even are, before knowing the contents of the documents or the claims the city will be making, is not in keeping with the spirit of the regulations and with sort of essential jurisprudence that that a complainant is required to tell the agency what matters are at issue. To the extent that the commission wishes to adopt these proposed final decisions as is, the orders for disclosure simply require that the respondents provide the unredacted records, with some exceptions, forthwith. We would ask that the commission at least extend that deadline for disclosure to the 45-day period afforded in Section 4-183 so that the respondents can evaluate the need to appeal to the Superior Court if needed. The harm to the complainant would be minimal because, again, not only did the complainant receive an initial disclosure, but after discussion between the parties received a supplemental disclosure with amended redactions. So allowing this additional time for the respondents to be able to, if needed, petition the court without being in violation of the disclosure order, we would appreciate that additional time. Thank you very much.
You lost me on that one. Why specifically do you need additional time? I understand the concept, obviously, but why? You must know what you have already, right?
I think that the 45 days, to the extent that the city will need to consult with its clients, will need to evaluate its own caseload, will need to perhaps have discussions with the complainant if needed. I think those 45 days would be beneficial, certainly.
Great. I'd entertain a motion.
Mr. Chairman, I move to after the hearing. And both cases, or do you want to do them separately?
Should we do them separately, Attorney Murphy?
Yeah, let's maybe do them separately.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I move to after the hearing officer's report in FIC 2022-0182.
Mr. Hank, a second.
Motion's been made and seconded. Is there discussion? Hearing none. I'll take a roll call of those in favor. Commissioner Einhorn?
Yes.
Mr. Fusashi?
Yes, and I'd like to add, just for the record, that I want to take particular note of both Attorney Fays and Attorney Scalo's arguments. I think the process of thought and articulation of the legal and issues here was particularly informative to me, and I also want to commend the hearing officer's report. So, yes. With three shout-outs to all three attorneys who took a role in this case, or a lead role in this case.
Thank you. Commissioner Hankins?
Yes.
Commissioner Streeter?
Yes.
And myself, Owen Egan, yes, passes unanimously.
Mr. Chairman, I move back to the hearing officer's report in FIC 2022-0183.
Mr. Hankins, second.
Motion's been made and seconded. Is there discussion? Hearing none, I'll take a roll call of those in favor. Commissioner Einhorn?
Yes.
Commissioner Fusashi?
Yes.
Mr. Hankins?
Yes.
Mr. Streeter?
Yes.
And myself, Owen Egan, yes, passes unanimously. Thank you both. Thank you, counsel. Great job. Thank you. Thank you, Attorney Schwinn. All right. Calling docket number FIC 2022-0347, Elliot Heyman versus First Selectwoman, Office of the Selectman, Town of Darien et al. The council, please identify themselves for the record.
Aaron Baer representing Elliot Heyman, the complainant.
Wayne Fox with the firm of Kerr, Springcroft and Merritt representing the Town of Darien.
Thank you. So, Attorney Fox, again?
Yes, sir. Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to be heard. I have no specific objection to the report that was issued. I think Mr. Housen did a very fine job.
It's hard to hear you. I'm sorry, Attorney Fox.
I do not have a specific objection to the report. Mr. Housen, hearing Mr. Housen, it's a significant period of time.
Excuse me, could you shut the door, please? It's hard to hear.
Writing a report, and I think that was well done. I do have a question of policy. There is somewhat inconsistency in what is 1-200 and 1-210 and what the facts allow in this case. Under 1-200, as I'm sure you well know, we would have the right to go into executive session in conjunction with the sale of real estate if, in fact, that discussion could lead to a modification or reduction of price. And that is applicable until such time as there is a closing and the deal is done or the deal is terminated. So to under 1-210, there is a provision whereby certain documents can be obtained and are exempt from disclosure, valuations of environmental issues and things of that nature. But in this case, where you have a contract which still has significant contingencies, in this case, the due diligence period ran for several months. It's just recently been terminated. We cannot go into executive session, even though that now becomes, even though full of contingencies and not a final contract, can be viewed by anyone who wishes to see it. I think that is something that I would respectfully submit your board consider in terms of future legislation.
Thank you. Attorney Bear.
I'll be brief, because of opposing counsel's concession that he has no objections to adoption of the hearing officer's report, and he also delivered by email to me yesterday afternoon the documents that my client requested. I do want to underscore the importance of a final FOIC decision in this matter, because the circumstances were unusual. This was a very, very narrowly tailored FOI request from back in July 2022. It asked only for a copy of a fully executed contract and fully executed amendments to that contract by the town of Darien to purchase property for what ended up being a price of $85 million in public funds. There was never a question in our view that these were disclosable under the act. And the town at the hearing did not even send someone to present testimony to defend its position that these documents did not need to be disclosed. The issue opposing counsel has raised, and he's conducted himself honorably throughout this process. I just think the town has taken from day one an unsupportable position in refusing to disclose public contracts like this. As to the issue he's raised for possible legislation, I would say it's covered briefly in our submission to the commission. But the definition of executive session in the public meetings portions of the act is not and has never been an amendment to or an additional basis for withholding production of documents. Those are separate sections of the act. It doesn't operate to amend the provisions of the act in 210B, which provide exemptions from mandatory disclosure. And I don't think it operates in that way here. I don't think there's inconsistency either, because if you are free, the standards are somewhat different. If under the definition of executive session, you can meet an executive session to discuss a potential purchase of property if it would affect the price, meaning the price might be adversely affected for a governmental entity. Here at the time, the price was already publicly stated. This had been in reports that the town had issued press releases reflecting the purchase price for the property, which was reflected in a fully executed contract. There is no exemption in the act for a contract that has a waiting period or has other ways for either party to withdraw from a contract. Those are common provisions in contracts, and doesn't excuse or exempt from disclosure a contract that's fully executed. Otherwise, you would never see a contract until the public funds have already been spent, which is exactly what my client was concerned about, that the $85 or $100 million would be spent because the deal would have been closed before anybody in the town of Darien got to see the contract that was called for that transaction. So I don't think there's an inconsistency. Certainly there isn't in this particular case, and I would urge the adoption of the hearing officer's report.
Thank you. Do any of the commissioners have anything they'd like to add?
Thank you.
Commissioner Fizeshi, anything?
No, I'm fine, thank you.
Okay. I'd entertain a motion.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioner Streeter, I move adoption of the hearing officer's report.
Commissioner Hatcher, second.
Motion's been made and seconded. Is there discussion? Hearing none, I'll take a roll call of those in favor. Commissioner Einhorn?
Yes.
Commissioner Fizeshi?
Yes.
Mr. Hankins?
Yes.
Mr. Streeter?
Yes.
And myself, Owen Egan, yes. Passes unanimously.
Thank you both.
Very good. Good job. Thank you. And finally, we're calling docket number FIC 2022-0540, Nancy Lallier versus Chairperson, Connecticut Technical Education and Career System Board et al. Would everyone please identify themselves for the record, starting with you, ma'am?
Hi, I'm Nancy Lallier.
Thank you.
Susan Scott on behalf of CTEX.
Thank you.
Robert Stallings, Chief of Staff for the Connecticut Technical Education and Career System, CTEX.
Can you repeat that, please?
Sure.
It's a mouthful.
That's a mouthful. CTEX is where we go, like CTEX.
That's fine.
Ron K. Stallings.
How do you spell your name?
R-O-N-K-E, last name Stallings, S-T-A-L-L-I-N-G-S.
And you're an attorney, correct?
No, I'm not. I'm the chief of staff for the system.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Thomas.
You're welcome.
Appreciate it. Attorney Scott, would you like to begin?
Yes, just briefly. This matter was the result of an exchange of emails between the complainant and respondent, where the complainant had been seeking to participate in public comment at one of the board meetings. And as noted in the hearing officer's proposed decision, respondent has maintained that the intent of the communications was not to prevent the complainant from attending or having access to the board meeting, but rather it was to communicate that she would not be able to participate in public comment because what she was seeking on addressing was not on the board agenda. Ultimately, the hearing officer concluded that it was reasonable for the complainant to have construed the communication in the way in which she did, that she was not to be not going to have access to the meeting. And in light of that finding, the respondent's explanation for this miscommunication is not so much offered as a defense or an excuse, but rather a mitigating circumstance. Respondent has no objection to the commission adopting the proposed decision and acknowledges its responsibilities under the FOI.
Thank you. Ms. Lally?
Yes, thank you for listening today. I just would like it to go on record that during the hearing, during our hearing, Ms. Stallings lied under oath, and she also slandered me during the hearing. In the email that she had sent to me, it had stated that to ensure the safety and security of our staff, your request to join the meeting is denied. When the hearing officer asked her why she did not feel safe or secure with me attending a public Board of Education meeting, she stated that at a previous Board of Education meeting that I attended, that I called the principal of Emmett O'Brien Technical School a no-neck monkey and other inappropriate names during that meeting. I did attend a meeting in December of 2021. However, I did not say any such thing, nor would I ever say any such thing. That's a public, our hearing that we had here is a public meeting. anybody from the public can access that meeting and hear her accusing me of saying those things that are not true. It goes to show, I mean, I would love to be able to show you why they denied my access. I've been going through this for over a year of trying to have my voice be heard. And Ms. Stallings came in here, raised her hand to tell the truth, and completely lied and slandered me. So I just wanted to make sure that the commission knew. I'm not sure if you review our hearing video, our hearing recordings or all, but I did bring it up then as well. It's a very scary thing when you entrust your child. My daughter attends a technical school, which is why I wanted to attend the board meeting, because I was having issues with the superintendent that I wanted to address. When they stop you from attending, and it's not just speaking, they had said that I wanted to speak. Yes, I would have liked to have been able to speak, but that's not what they denied me. They denied my attendance at the meeting, not that they denied me public comment time. It's very clear in her email that she did not want me to join the meeting. So I just wanted to make sure that you were aware of Ms. Ronke's deceitfulness when it comes to answering questions and answering for herself. Thank you.
I don't believe it was, a fundamental part of the decision and not referenced in the decision, so that the complainant shouldn't worry that there's any consequence of that being, part of the decision. And I don't think it's ultimately relevant to what the commission is going to be deciding today.
Thank you. Do the commissioners have any questions?
Just one question.
Mr. Hankins?
Yes, thank you. Ma'am, did you have a chance to cross-examine the witnesses?
Yes, I did.
Thank you.
I was just going to say that you know, Attorney Scott's an officer of the court. She would not have taken an oath at a hearing.
I did not know.
I was saying a fact. You didn't have to answer.
It was a rhetorical.
It was rhetorical. She's an officer of the court. Yes. They don't swear, and they don't take the oath. So there was nothing. She was beholden by the court. Mr. Chairman, Mr. Trudeau, I move it off to the hearing on support.
Mr. Hackett, second.
Motion's been made and seconded. Is there discussion? Hearing none, I'll take a roll call of those in favor. Commissioner Einhorn?
Yes.
Commissioner Kuzeshi?
Yes.
Commissioner Hankins?
Yes.
Commissioner Streeter?
Yes.
And myself, Chairman Owen Egan, yes. Passes unanimously.
Thank you.
Thank you all.
Items 3 through 7 are on our agenda, which were all complaints filed by Mr. Godbout. This is the submission. We're all withdrawn on Monday, I believe. So these were requests to deny me to schedule hearings in the matter, and Mr. Godbout withdrew all of them. So there's nothing before you at this time.
Quick question. So do we add these to the list of the growing list of cases where he goes to right to the end? And then,
yes, we will.
All right,
we'll keep those in our memory bank for sure.
I think they're added into, the ones like that were added into PRBR number 1 also.
Right, we did. So then we'll go to item number 8, which is the first time I think that this type of matter has come before you, where we have a consideration of notice of executive director's recommendation to deny a petition for relief from vexatious requester in Town of Thomaston versus Nancy and William Griswold, and it's our PRVR number 5. So in this one, under the statute, if we get a petition, the executive director, along with my very helpful staff, will review the petition and try to make a determination about whether a hearing appears to be warranted based on the papers, and again, a hearing about whether somebody's a vexatious requester. So in this instance, in reviewing the petition and the statute, I didn't feel that this rose to the level that the
that the evidence that was proffered in the petition really rose to the level of demonstrating that the Griswolds were vexatious requesters. There are a number of prongs in the statute that we look at under 1206B5. Just to give you a little listing, there was reference to 6 complaints that were filed by the complainants in a 7-month period, actually just one complainant. No complaints filed by, I think it was Mr. Griswold. And although the request for records appears to be kind of broad, the subject matter was not. It was related to one particular topic. The content language used did not appear to be aggressive, harassing in any way, really. There was no evidence of other, quote unquote, like bad behavior in other contexts. Didn't appear that the requests were made in bad faith, and no pattern that amounted to an abuse of the right to access information, at least at the juncture that this was filed. So in accordance with the statute, if the executor or the director doesn't feel that a hearing is warranted, I put it before you and try to give you some of the reasons why. And then afterward, should you support my decision to deny the petition for relief, we will send notice to the petitioner and the subjects of this, and it'll outline some of those reasons in more detail even than I just gave you now, and that's required by statute as well. So I'd ask in this instance that you uphold my decision to, my recommendation to deny the petition for relief from vexatious requester.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Commissioner Streeter, I move that we uphold the executive director's recommendation to deny petition for relief in this matter of the vexation requester.
I will second.
Motion's made and second. Is there discussion?
Yes, respectfully. I've read the 34-page petition with great interest. I thought it was well written, but the respondent, you know, did not quite cross the Rubicon into vexatious requester territory. Both vexatious requesters in PRVR numbers 1 and 4, you know, showed an obsessive, unhinged behavior, demonstrating an odious and severe disconnect with reality. It was clearly to vex and harass municipalities. There was no mention of PRVR number 4, I don't think, in the 34 pages, the 34-page petition. They only mentioned number 1, so I don't know if they were aware of it. But, you know, there, you know, it showed the some of the actions of the, you know, it was found by the commission that the person, the requester, went, you know, going into a witness's website to provide a defamatory rating. You know, they followed a witness to a men's room to berate them, and then they provided in their brief a written commentary on male urination. You know, they lied about matters. They went into bizarre diatribes and rants, you know, verbally and attacking and threatening the attorneys representing the municipalities. So, you know, it really falls short. And they may be a nascent vexatious requester, but not right now. That's all I have to say.
Very poetic.
Thank you. Thank you. It wasn't as long as Commissioner Streeter today, but.
Great. So, is there any more?
We like, because of the time, we missed 3 weeks. So
yeah, there you go. Okay.
That's tough.
Any further discussion? Hearing none, I'll take a roll call of those in favor. Commissioner Einhorn?
Yes.
Commissioner Fizashi?
Yes.
Commissioner Hankins?
Yes.
Commissioner Streeter?
Yes.
And myself, Owen Egan? Yes. Passes unanimously.
Thank you. Moving on to item 9, we are going to consider the appellate court decision dated April 4th in Sarah Brash versus the FOI Commission, which upheld the commission's decision, argued by Attorney Ross, but presented to you today by Attorney Harmon.
Yeah, good afternoon. This is a really good decision for the commission. I think you'll recall that this case had to do with the complainant slash the plaintiff calling Yale University Police
identifying herself as a student and a resident of one of the resident halls at Yale, and alleging that a woman who she did not know was sleeping in a common room, and that she told the Yale police that she thought that perhaps this woman was sleeping in the room to provoke her as part of an ongoing conflict that she was having with students. And the Yale police responded and investigated and determined that, investigated it as a criminal matter, and then determined that there was no criminal aspect to the investigation. The plaintiff, the complainant before us, and the plaintiff wanted the body cam videos that were taken of her and the woman who had been sleeping in the resident hall, and the Yale police denied her request, stating that they were exempt under 1-210B3 as records, uncorroborated criminal allegations. So the Superior Court agreed with us, and the plaintiff appealed to the appellate court. It's interesting that the plaintiff tried to re-argue the case before the appellate court, saying that her primary concern was directed at what she said was the commission's finding that when she called the police on a non-emergency line, that she alleged that the third party, the young lady who was sleeping in the hall, that the commission had said that the complainant had alleged that the third party was engaged in criminal activity, and that the commission had said that the complainant had alleged that that third party was trespassing and harassing her. And the appellate court really zoomed in on what the commission's decision said and what Attorney McGee wrote. And it said that the commission found that the plaintiff had alleged that the woman who she did not know was sleeping in the common room, and that the person may have been sleeping in the room to provoke her, but not that it was criminal. The court correctly, the appellate court correctly recognized that the hearing officer and then the commission found that the department construed what the caller had said as possible criminal activity. And then the commission found that because Yale police had construed that as possible criminal and investigated it as possible criminal activity, and ultimately determined that it wasn't criminal activity, that the commission properly found that the records contained uncorroborated allegations, and that the whole record, as was stated in Bona and recognized by the hearing officer, that when you have a report that contains uncorroborated allegations, the whole report is exempt. That's pretty standard, going back to Bona. Complainant wanted to argue to the court that her intent, like why she called, that she didn't call for a criminal matter. And the court said, really, you know, it's not why you call. There's no basis, the court said, in law or in logic, that the complainant's subjective intent should control how the Yale Police Department would arrive and investigate. So I think that the appellate court really kind of really followed what the commission said and what the commission found, really zoned in on it. It was really good. What was interesting to me is that the complainant before this commission and also before the Superior Court had alleged that because the Yale police gave those recordings to the dean for purposes of determining whether a disciplinary action should be brought against the caller, that that her equal protection rights were violated because the reports, the videos were given over, or the dean was allowed to see them, but she wasn't allowed to get a copy. And the commission found that, you know, we weren't going to determine, we weren't going to get into the equal protection argument, that we didn't have jurisdiction, and the Superior Court agreed with the commission. Interestingly, the court said that the commission could, in the future, address allegations that the as applied, someone's equal protection rights were violated. So not that the commission can say certain
aspects of the FOI Act are void and determined they're unconstitutional. But as the act was applied, the appellate court said the commission could consider the plaintiff's equal protection arguments and could analyze whether the plaintiff and the dean were similarly situated in terms of why the plaintiff was denied the records and why the dean was allowed to have some limited access to the records. And it was interesting. So applying the FOI Act and denying this plaintiff those records, but allowing the dean, the court said that we really could look at the equal protection argument. So it's interesting because we've really never seen, I haven't seen higher courts say that we should perhaps address the constitutional aspect of how the act was applied to certain requesters as opposed to other requesters and whether they were similarly situated. So it's interesting. I think it's a really strong decision. I think it was very complimentary to the hearing officer and to the commission.
Any questions?
Yes, Mr. Commissioner Fusashi, I just wonder if we could just hear a little bit more from Colleen and at least about that last finding or I don't know what title that finding, but the statement of the court about these equal protection arguments that the commission could consider. I'm trying to figure out what that means for us in the future and not to read too much into it, but not to ignore it.
Yeah, right. I think that's a...
It's important to me. It sounds very... When I read it, it just jumped out at me as...
Yeah, me too. Right. I think that's a great...
I don't have enough history to know if we have had that kind of court at this level, court dictum or court... I don't know to that effect and for us to think about what that means.
I don't think so, Commissioner. I don't think we've ever had a court tell us that. And we usually, you know, not that it's raised very much, but sometimes people do raise constitutional claims. And I think we have looked at it that, like, we can't find a statute unconstitutional. That's not our role. So the court, yes, is making some kind of distinction here that we can look at how a statute is applied. And it worked out factually well here to look at that analysis because the claim was like, you know, well, you gave the, you did a disclosure to the dean, but you're not disclosing it to me. And, you know, the court there was able to say, well, you know, there is no due process issue because these two folks are not similarly situated. The dean, it wasn't like an FOI disclosure to the dean. There were certain reasons why the dean should have access to the records. So the court was able to dispose of it that way. I mean, I think it'll rarely come up, but I think it's something that we will be talking about at our next attorney meeting because we typically, you know, pretty much sidestep the constitutional issue, but I think we're typically thinking of it in the context of, you know, we don't have the authority to find a statute unconstitutional. So I think this is unique and new, and I don't know exactly how it'll impact us in the future, but I think we'll talk about it for sure.
I would just say from a distance, again, I apologize, but this could be something that parties raise sua sponte. So I sense a new line of argument that we should think about and prepared, and because if I was in, I think it could come sua sponte in arguments. People have sort of, even in my 3 years, have argued it, but we've sort of, and now there's a court decision of mid-level with the dictum. I don't know if we call it a holding or dictum, but in it. So I circled it with a big magic marker for us to think about and be a little prepared for.
We've seen that before.
We've seen the argument, but in your time, wouldn't normally say that's not for us to decide.
No, but we've seen it before where we would have probably denied the dean access to that record if an FOI request was made.
Right, if it had been made.
So they violated the law for one and didn't violate it for the others. And but we've seen that before. And it's not us to decide, yes, you can violate the law because you've already violated it here. We've ruled on cases like that, haven't we?
well, I'm not sure. We've had situations where like one newspaper got access to something and another newspaper didn't. And we have allowed the agency to still, if there is an applicable exemption, to claim the exemption. Like typically we say, well, it's not a waiver. No, it really hasn't.
No.
It really hasn't.
Not to draw it out. Yeah, I was going to say that I'm not sure I agree with the judge. I mean, the ramifications of this is that, well, look at, I guess, zoning, for example, right? So every time you deny a zoning, something from the Board of Zoning Appeals to build a shed or something in your backyard, now you have to look at all the other neighbors and see who you did grant it to. So is it unconstitutional as applied? I mean, I don't think, from the way I understand it, it's not saying the statute's unconstitutional, but it's as applied.
Very as applied.
Which is, I think, opens a very odd door for other boards and agencies to apply that, where it's never been part of the decision process, right?
Yeah.
For agencies. So anyway.
I know Judge Prescott raised it at oral argument. Judge Suarez wrote the decision, but I know Judge Prescott really pressed this issue at oral argument to Attorney Ross. So why didn't you analyze why the dean was able to see the body cams and analyze why, in reference to why the complainant was not? And I think, I don't think the court is saying we should go and look at other statutes, but when someone is allowed access and someone isn't allowed access, I think the court is saying that we can analyze whether those two individuals are similarly situated in terms of an equal protection claim. And I think that the dean was able to get the records to an order, and not through an FOI request, just because she was dean, in terms of determining whether there should be some disciplinary action taken. And she had limited access to those records, limited by FERPA, so that she couldn't really disclose them. It wasn't an FOI request. And I think the court said we probably should have looked at how the plaintiff and the dean were or were not similarly situated in terms of the FOI Act. I think they invited it.
Have we ever done that before?
Not to my knowledge. But I mean, to the extent that one person made an FOI request and one person is, you know, conducting some sort of private institution disciplinary proceeding, and I don't think the dean got copies. I think the dean was able to view the video, and I think that the plaintiff was also offered a viewing of the videos, but she did not want to view them. She wanted a copy. And the purpose of the dean was whether disciplinary proceedings should be started. And I think the court was really clear that the purpose of the plaintiff was that she wanted to make these records public to the world. So they really weren't similarly situated. One was an FOI request and one was not, and I don't know, the court did seem to say that.
I'm more concerned about how using that decision affects other parts of municipal government. But it seems to me the dean, you know, if you look at it, the fact that the police officers are paid by Yale University,
yes.
She's part of Yale University. I think she really has a pretty strong argument, as beside the safety of students and so forth. She's got a pretty strong argument that she's not in the same position of a third party who makes a request. I would say you have a pretty strong public policy argument that the dean probably should be able to do these.
It was
things.
Interesting,
it
would have
been a stronger argument if it was the New Haven police that came and they showed it to the dean of the university, as opposed to being.
No, Yale police are operate under New Haven badges.
Oh, they do?
Yeah, they're paid by Yale, but when I was a commissioner, we train them, we hire them. We don't hire them. We recommend them to Yale.
But their
Yale
oversight thing, also has.
They can do any arrest in the city of New Haven.
Right.
But I'm saying that there's a difference if it was a non.
Yeah.
Yale University police officer that's a New Haven police officer.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I agree.
It was interesting.
It is.
I mean, it's something to consider. You know, it's something for the commission to consider if we do get that kind of argument in the future. I don't think it should be our main line of analysis, but we could consider whether we want to at least address the similarly situated argument that is kind of
the core of the equal protection. You know, I don't want to use
more
poetic rubicons here, but
it jumped out at me too. And I know when Attorney Ross came back, she was like,
Judge Prescott wanted to know from the bench why we didn't address this. And it's like, what? So she was a little caught off guard by it too. But it, you know, it's a strong decision, and it really, a lot of times the appellate court will parrot what the superior court says, but, you know, to give the hearing officer her due here, it really went back to what the hearing officer said and, you know, bypassed what the court said and really kind of zoned in on what Attorney McGee had said. And that's how this is held together. So it's a good decision.
Thank you.
Attorney McGee is listening.
That's fine. She's talking over there so she can hear me.
That's why you're pointing that way?
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks. No other report on pending appeals? I said nothing under 11 or
12,
but I did want to turn the floor over to Paula just to talk about legislative report.
Thank you.
Came up with a graphic summary of the most active bills. Unfortunately, there's more than one.
I think maybe just speak to these. I mean, on our tracking, there are over 280 bills, but I figured I'd pare it down to the ones that made it out of committee and the ones that we're actively trying to address at this point. I won't go through all of it, but I would say, so there's a couple, you know, the bills out there that made it out of committee or the Government Administration Elections Committee and also the Planning and Development Committee. One deals with an exemption for records kept or maintained by public universities. The initial bill that was raised in committee focused more on research and access to research and studies. The bill that made it out of committee, we believe, is much broader and could arguably, you know, or you could argue that it actually applies to all records maintained by public universities, which essentially would mean that public universities are exempt from, you know, FOI. So it really is broad and it's concerning. We're hoping to work with the proponents. They have not really been reaching out to us. This bill is one of the ones that we are extremely concerned about. Like, as I said, it really would mean that most of the records of public universities would be exempt from disclosure.
How do you define a public university? Is it just state universities there's plenty of other public universities.
What's in the statute says public institution of higher education.
That's not very good, I don't think.
So I think it could be community colleges, yeah. It could be state colleges, you could be UConn, which is very big. So I think it would apply to those. The other one that is particular concern is the one that would exempt from disclosure whistleblower complaints in their entirety. The commission had a recent case it's probably about a year old now, dealing with the Port Authority, in which the commission found that the whistleblower complaint in that particular case was exempt from disclosure because it would reveal the identity of the whistleblower, which is covered under statute. But the commission also noted that it's really a case-by-case determination and that really whistleblower complaints should not always be exempt from disclosure unless it would reveal the identity of the whistleblower. And the auditors right now, and also the Attorney General, but it's being really pressed by the auditors, want to exempt the complaint in its entirety, always.
Our chamber quality.
That is another one. We've met with the auditors, and we have another meeting coming up with the auditors, and see if there's some way to compromise. So to be be continued on that one. There are a couple of bills that are still active dealing with adding to the 1-217, the exemptions for residential addresses. One of them would add the employees of the Attorney General's office, which is a bill that's been before the legislature in past sessions. This year, the proposal would also add certain employees of the Department of Aging and Disability Services. So, and I emphasize certain employees, so it wouldn't exempt all of their employees, but these two particular divisions, you know, why those two and not the others, it seems if you're going to do it, you would apply to all of them. But so that one, and then there's another one dealing with residential addresses that would apply to public employees and election workers who may serve on a voluntary basis. For instance, municipal clerks, registrar of voters, deputy registrar of voters, election officials, primary officials, and audit officials. So this would be actually the first time that the address exemption would be expanded to apply to non-public employees, which is very interesting. So right now, as you know, the statute applies just to public employees, and now you would be bringing in individuals who are serving on a voluntary basis. There's also within one of those bills dealing with residential addresses, there's a section dealing with notice to employees when there's being a MASS request for personnel files, so that if a request is made for the personnel files of 50 or more employees, the agency would first inform the employee that their request was made, regardless of whether or not it would be an invasion of privacy, and then it could give out the records, which really it runs counter to what the law, what happened back in 2018, where a distinction was made in terms of when you provide notice to an employee. So currently the statute reads that if the agency believes it's an invasion of privacy, you provide the employee with notice, and then if there's no objection, you give it out. If the agency doesn't believe it's an invasion of privacy, you give out the records, and then you let the employee know. We gave out the records, but we wanted you to know that there was a request made. So it's essentially trying to undo what was fixed in 2018. We think it comes out of a concern from the unions with respect to requests that, I'm not even sure how to phrase it. So, you know, requests are made for these records of public employees, and there might be unions who are trying to reach, or not unions, like anti-union individuals trying to contact the union members and, you know, kind of discouraging them from being part of unions. We think that's where it's coming from. We have not been reached out. You know, no one's reached out to us. We've asked about it, but we haven't quite. I don't know if Colleen has an update on that, but let's see. I'm trying to quickly through this. There's the body cam bill is still active. As you know, we had been working with the Connecticut Police Chiefs Association to try to come up with a fee structure for allowing agencies to charge for the redaction of the fees. I think with respect to that portion of the proposal, I think it's fair, it's reasonable. But there is also a portion of the bill that adds some new exemptions, and those we're concerned about. So we're been trying to reach out to folks about that. One that we really like, is there's the one that would allow FOI Commission to impose a penalty up to $10,000. And so that's still very active bill, and it also would empower the commission to seek some additional judicial relief, which is we're supportive of the bill. The language dealing with the additional judicial relief, it's written a little awkward, and I'm not quite sure how it would work, but we're working on some substitute language to try to make it to work to give empower the commission to seek more relief, but just in a way that's feasible. And the last two that I have on the list, here's the bill that would require that if you're participating remotely, that you always have to be visible on video. The issue with that is that the current law allows commissioners to also appear via telephone. So it's you can't allow via telephone and also require to appearing via video. So it we support the proposal, but it just needs to be clarified whether or not the intent is still to allow board members to appear by telephone. And then lastly, the bill that is proposing or requiring public comment at meetings, which we all realized like there was issues with that because it would also require that our adjudicatory hearings that we would have to allow public comment. It has been voted out of committee, but with substitute language creating a task force of which executive director or designee would be a member. Oh, and one that I didn't have on this list because it didn't have any concerns, it's the FOI proposal. So they made it out of committee as is. So that is not on the list because this one's really ones that we had concerns about. But that's where we stand. And I could go on and on about the other ones, but
I have one question for you. I'm sorry, could you go, the first item on your list, I'm still digesting that. Public education institutions. This is a bill that's come out of committee or is somebody submitted to committee?
It has come out of committee. So the original bill that was proposed and received a public hearing appeared to be more focused on records dealing with research and studies.
It sounded to me like research maybe, but that's not what came out. Okay.
So correct. So that's not the way we're reading it. It's much broader than that.
And it's a standalone bill? It's not somehow?
Yes. It's a standalone bill.
I don't want to go. I personally can't fathom that in my mind yet. So I would be a little bit interested. Citation, a little bit more on that. Email you or whatever, because I can't fathom it. we're public university education, public institutions, publicly funded, high profile, years of publishing salaries among the highest earners in the state of Connecticut. So somehow it just it's hard for me to fathom that could be intended.
I agree.
That's why we're working on that one.
Yeah, thank you. I'm sorry. I just went back. So you just confirmed for me that it's out of committee, which is a big step.
Yes.
Although we've been meeting with some legislators to raise our concerns, so I think our voice is being heard a little bit on it. We'll see.
Thank you.
Right?
There'll be some confusion, some backstory there that's not clear yet. Thank you. Thank you very much.
I guess, Colleen, just the one non-bill related matter. So there was a governor recommended someone for one of the vacant commissioner positions, and her hearing is next week. It's supposed to be next week.
Who is it?
Her name is Anya Goldsby, and she's a lawyer, and currently resides in Simsbury. She works for a law firm right now. She's supposed to have her confirmation hearing, we think, on Tuesday. So she should be joining soon.
Cool. Great.
Yeah. We still have two additional openings that we have been in communication with the governor's office about. So
we'll get to see the swearing-in ceremony. That always makes me
right.
So emotional.
You'll get the swearing-in ceremony soon. Okay. Thanks, Paula.
Thank you
for all of that, I think.
Thanks, Paul.
Just no more proposals legislatively. Who's here listening to Commissioner Streeter? Save that for next year.
Next year.
Okay, that's all I have. That's all we have.
I move we adjourn.
Second.
Commissioner Fayden, second. I'll take a roll call of those in favor. Commissioner Einhorn?
Yes.
Commissioner Gazeshi?
Yes.
Commissioner Hankins?
Yes.
Commissioner Streeter?
Yes.
myself, Owen Egan, yes, we're adjourned. Thank you, everyone. Great job. Great job, everybody.
That was good.